Welcome to the Island Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. I'm back in Minneapolis for a little bit. Ethan Sherwood-Strauss, you are in the Bay Area. How's it going?
It's going well. It's a little bit overcast. I do miss the Warriors. I miss going to the games, but we have some pretty intense playoffs, and I'm doing okay, Zach.
It's been fun, right? The playoffs? I know people were down on it because home teams were destroying everything early on, but I feel like it's been fun.
Well, it's been half of fun. It's been fun on one end. There's this really intense Pacers-Heat series, and that's been cool. And then there's this series that America doesn't care about, partially for good reason, because it hasn't turned out to be a very good series unless you're a Spurs fan, and that's the Grizz versus San Antonio. That one is kind of a snoozer.
Okay, I have a question for you then. Is it is it strictly not good because the Grizzlies can't win a game? Can it can you have a good series be just short? Because that's how I felt about the finals last year. I felt the finals were a really good finals, but it only went five games. But you know, the majority of the games were close. And then in this series, you know, we've had two games go to overtime, but it doesn't feel great. It doesn't feel like great basketball.
That was a really good finals, and it's funny how it's remembered. We've talked about how Kevin Durant was brilliant in it, and it's forgotten because his team lost. Something similar happened the year before. Dwayne Wade was the best player in the 2011 finals, but it's just not going to be remembered that way. Well, I let me put it this way. There was some intellectual gratification in watching Spurs-Grizzlies. I stupidly picked the Grizzlies, but just seeing the Spurs take apart that Memphis offense and just really zero in on how Tony Allen can't shoot and how they're going to just devote attention to Zach Randolph and force him right and blanket him while ignoring Tony Allen, ignoring Tayshaun Prince. It was cool to just witness what they did and also what they did offensively. But after that, you feel as though, okay, the math problem has been solved as to why the Spurs are going to win this. That's been figured out, and now we're just kind of waiting, and it'd be nice to have some tension. It'd be nice to have some drama and some uncertainty, and it's hard to maintain interest without a little bit of uncertainty.
Let's say this. Here's a hypothetical. Let's say the Grizzlies win the next two games but lose game six. Can it then be a great series even though they went down 3-0 and there's no real shot of them winning the series?
Ooh, that's a good point, because then for most of the series, there isn't all that much drama. Even though we've had two games in a row go to overtime, which is funny. Like it really feels like a clean Spurs sweep, which is hard to say three times fast, I think. But we've had two overtime games. I guess I just kind of feel like I feel like the Grizzlies were never really in the first of the overtime games, even though they came back. It just seemed random and fluky, and Tony Allen with the flagrant foul thing at the end. And it just never felt as though Memphis was in that game, even though they tied it right at the end. As to your question, yes, it could become a good series if it goes six. It depends on the circumstances. That just would be a surprise if it went six based on what's happened.
What's funny is that this ends up being a correct feeling because it worked out that way, but it could have easily been wrong. But in game three, I think Conley misses like a teardrop layup attempt at the end of regulation, and they go to overtime. And when he missed that shot, I thought, oh, crap, well, now they've lost. Because I just just assumed the Spurs would out-execute them. You give them more minutes to play basketball, the Spurs' execution is probably going to win out against a team that struggles to score like this. And so, like, that feeling, like, the Spurs end up winning overtime, and my feeling becomes true. But I felt that at the time, and it could have just easily, like, oh, the Spurs could have fallen apart, the Grizzlies could have won that quarter, and then I would have been even more confused about the series.
Yeah. I'm mulling getting into the I have two decisions before me.
Okay.
I can get into the nitty-gritty with you about the series, like a responsible basketball writer, like the person I'm supposed to be. Or I can do what I've mostly been doing on Twitter, and that is to be more interested in why people aren't interested in it and be more interested in the Spurs fan backlash, which is just quickly rising up the ranks as the most insecure and angry a fan base is, with good reason. I don't even blame them. I think I would have a little bit of that were I a Spurs fan, but Bill Simmons is talking about it, Zach Lowe's talking about it. The Spurs fan base, far more fiery and impassioned than the team they root for.
Yeah, it is interesting that we've got, I mean, there's always backlash to the backlash. So the Spurs fan base has backlash against the media and the lack of attention, the lack of knowledge about the team, which is understandable. But then the backlash to that is even some Spurs writers saying, look, this team shuts us out. They shut everybody out. Like, they don't want the attention. They don't want any of that. So you're mad at the media, but the media can only get so far if the team won't grant any access. And so I do wonder where that middle ground is. Like, it's not one or the other. It's somewhere in between. And it's probably closer to the whole access thing, but I don't know. I feel like KG, I mean, the Wolves are more open with
but think of the way KG and Duncan were very similar players. Duncan is now defined in people's minds by how he plays as an older guy, but if you look at rookie Tim Duncan and young Tim Duncan, he is spry. He is just this, I would put it a center. You know, a center's body playing power forward, swatting shots, passing well, dribbling well, cool Kevin McHale-esque post moves.
Yeah.
This wasn't an inherently boring product. Just Kevin Garnett became cool to people and Tim Duncan wasn't, based on how the public interacted with those two players.
Well, Kevin Garnett was more boisterous. He was more hip-hop as the league was kind of gaining that. The whole Marbury KG phenomena with that slam cover of them with chains and a backwards visor and all kinds of stuff. Like, they were more of the highlight reel as the league kind of gravitated towards that Iverson era that you love so much. whereas Duncan was more reserved. I wouldn't say he was boring. He was just kind of surgical, and that's. Well, I guess that is boring. Like, that's nobody wants to watch a show about just routine surgeries. People want to watch ERs where people have to get put in ICU immediately and all kinds of that's what people want to watch. And so Duncan's style of play was intricate and intriguing, but it was also boring because it was so efficient. Whereas KG's dropping behind the back passes and he's dunking on people, and Tim Duncan was stretching out to dunk over people, whereas KG was jumping. And so, they're both small market teams, and the Wolves are more let's get some word out about our players, whereas the Spurs very much aren't. But I don't know. Tim Duncan should be a bigger star. Bomani Jones has taken this up. You've taken this up on Twitter. This is a really great player.
Well, here's something. If Tim Duncan played for the Knicks, I always throw this example out there, nobody would find him boring. He would not be boring. He would be the great center, the great power forward, Tim Duncan, with just this beautiful game. I mean, oh my God, in the mecca of basketball, the post moves he's dropping, it is just a vision. This big men have died out, but here we have a great one in Tim Duncan. It would be a wholly different story. Nobody would be bored because they'd have this vested interest, the people of New York, in being interested. So that is one aspect, the small market is. The other one is that he's of this culture, the Spurs culture, where you shut out the media. I mean, my God, he's been in front of cameras for a long time, and he intentionally handles it as though it's a hostage video. When Doris Burke was interviewing him, it's just, we didn't play that well, and last time and this time we sort of turned it around. We're playing better, flat, no eye contact. I mean, what is that?
Maybe we should get him to start holding up a current newspaper with each interview so we know that it's not just some canned footage. Maybe that's what we should do. So I guess it is the Spurs' fault.
Well, yes, I would say so, if you want to call it a fault, because they don't care. That's why this is such a complicated conversation. You're in essence blaming them for losing an election that they never intended to take part in.
Okay, here's my next question then, to cut you off.
Yes.
Is it the Spurs' fault, but also the media's fault that they didn't try harder? Did the media just give up?
No. I know that it's this default position to say, hey, it's some of this, and hey, it's some of that. I put all the blame on the Spurs. Okay. And because and hey, when I say blame is you know, I'm using that term broadly because they don't care. I'm blaming them, quote unquote, for something that they profess to not care about. So it's not like they screwed up. This is by design for them. They don't care if the league makes more money. It doesn't do anything for them. It doesn't impact them. So yeah, they cut off media attention. I was lucky enough to be able to write a little bit about Andrew Bynum's knee and what Gary Vee and the Lakers did to make him better. They were pretty cooperative and nice about it. I had some similar questions about how the Spurs were able to cull the plantar fasciitis of Duncan and Parker, and just a very curt, I wouldn't say rude, but just shuts you down at the beginning. Yeah. Just no, it's not going to happen. And, you know, that's but one example. Far more prominent writers than myself. I mean, I think McCollum and Poznanski and Chris Ballard have all written about just the process of trying to write about the Spurs.
Yeah.
And the difficulties inherent. And so it's a real thing. It's a real thing. And eventually the national writer, I'm not considering myself this, but the nationally prominent writer or maybe a media, a TV person trying to get access to this organization goes, screw you. This is San Antonio.
Well, I think on the flip side of that is we've seen the Grizzlies have been very open. They're a small market. The Pacers have been very open. I was really impressed at how open of an environment the Pacers had. I was in Miami for the first two games, and I couldn't believe how open like Frank Vogel is.
Yeah. Oh, he's candid.
Yeah.
Folks, he's a candid great personality. He reminds me of a character in Saving Private Ryan. Sorry.
I still haven't seen it.
You haven't seen Saving Private Ryan?
It's been on my DVR for about 9 months.
What?
Yeah.
How can you not have seen Saving Private Ryan?
Every time I start to look at like watch it, I think I don't have 3 hours right now, and I feel like
people
I want to watch it
like
all the
you.
Way through.
People like you are why Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture that year. That's on your head.
How dare you? I didn't even watch that.
Well, you know, hey, if you don't watch and then somebody else doesn't watch, then suddenly the fallback plan is just to reward a movie for being British, as Hollywood does.
So it's like the whole thing. Bad. If you don't tell a friend and they don't tell any friends, then no one's told any friends and the terrorists win. Are you calling Shakespeare in Love
a
terrorist?
The British win. I wouldn't make that comparison of the British to that, but yes, the British by default, the insecure Hollywood elite go, oh my god, that guy has an accent. Oh geez, we got to give him every award, otherwise we'll like Philistines.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Wouldn't the Spurs make more money if the NBA made more money? Because there'd be more revenue to share.
Well, I think this is the story of the NBA and
or
why
is
it's
not enough. Is it not? Is it like, oh, we get $3 million extra dollars? We'd rather not go through the work of it all.
Well, I believe this is more or less the story of the NBA, which is the interests aren't aligned enough. The interests of the league as a whole aren't aligned enough with the interests of owners as individuals, which is why we have so many problems that just persist.
Yeah.
And this is an element where they're not. I suppose they get TV revenue, the national TV games that's split through for every team, you know, 1 to 30, and then you just get your local ratings, you get your local TV deal, and your attendance. And if you're the Spurs, what more do you need than to be popular within the San Antonio area and to get your attendance? That's just your primary source of revenue. You're not getting any money since jersey sales are split all the way through. You're not getting a chunk for Tim Duncan jerseys sold in China that's any bigger than the chunk that the Milwaukee Bucks will get. So because of that, you just don't have much incentive to put yourself out there.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. And I guess really like the whole revenue aspect is only relevant now. Like they didn't have it that much before to where it'd be worth it. So then you create that culture and now, I mean, you're not going to change it just because of now.
What's interesting to me is it worked so well because you've got these unique people involved.
Yeah.
Popovich not ever wanting to talk about himself and being a genius. Tim Duncan being this fantastic player who is wholly ready to subsume his self into the greater good and not be that superstar. And then Manu Ginobili to a certain extent. Tony Parker obviously likes a little bit more attention. So it's a unique environment. I almost wonder if Sam Presti went awry trying to just make the next situation a complete copy of the Spurs situation when he had different people he was dealing with. Obviously, the Thunder are a huge success overall, but you look at stuff like, they just tried to make James Harden Manu Ginobili. They just right. Like, hey James, you're Manu Ginobili. You know, you'll be cool with taking less money and coming off the bench to back up Thabo Sefolosha at the age of 23, even though you don't have the health problems Ginobili did, which is a huge factor in why he came off the bench. You're cool with that, right? You know, forever. That's cool, right? Oh my God, you're leaving. What's going on?
Right, and also like,
what's happening?
It doesn't work if James Harden doesn't have an incredible European career before he comes to the NBA. Like, I'm sure his time at Arizona State was very fun, but it's not quite the same success that Ginobili had. He wasn't making millions of dollars in Europe with free, you know, a free house and all kinds of like fine dining and an incredible life.
Yeah, it was just very unique that Ginobili was cool with that. And you look and it totally impacts his legacy. He's one of the greatest shooting guards to ever play, and he doesn't quite have that profile, despite how brilliant he was, because we apportion a lot of credit based on somebody's raw numbers, which is connected to the amount of minutes they play. I mean, James Harden got a lot of credit for being on a great team last year, but he didn't make the All-NBA team. He was better than a few guys who did. This year, he's on the All-NBA team. This year, he's on the All-Star team. So it is a sacrifice in that role of credit and of fame. And with how the NBA works, with how we just give all the credit to the best player on a team that wins, hey, not everybody's down with that. Not everybody wants that. I don't claim to know what's in James Harden's head, but I do find it amusing that the Thunder were asking him to come off the bench and give up tens of millions of dollars. You can't do both. You can do one, maybe. You can't do both.
So then you're saying James Harden's selfish.
Hey, to be great, I think a lot of these guys are selfish. I would be selfish if I was James Harden.
Oh, God. I would be Ricky Davis. I would assume everyone was coming to help me win a title.
I mean, my greater point is that the Thunder were a little bit perhaps hard-headed and selfish. And the reason why at that time I would have favored trading Westbrook over Harden is because they artificially depressed Harden's trade value by having him come off the bench in this role, which made people wonder, can he handle the full load? Can he be the man?
Yeah.
You know, it was maybe good for getting him to take less money, putting him in that six-man role, but trade value-wise, that's how you don't get a top 10 pick back.
Well, they would have had a top 10 pick. I mean, the Raptors just kind of surged after they had a brief surge after the Rudy Gay trade, right?
I believe at the time,
maybe they were about 10.
A lot of people thought the Raptors were going to make the playoffs in that preseason, so. This is more or less around where we thought they would end up, and it would have been foolish for them to expect a top 10 pick. Now, granted, 10 is sort of an arbitrary cutoff point. The main point is that I'm just amused. I just thought about the 12th pick they get. Has there ever been more pressure on nailing a 12th pick and getting a 12th pick right?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe – I'm sure the Warriors had something with Anthony Randolph or wherever the hell they picked him. I'm sure there was a lot of pressure there.
Bryant.
Patrick, he was like ninth. He was a ninth pick. He follows me on Twitter.
Oh my God, that's so strange.
Yeah, he's followed me on Twitter for forever, it feels like.
I wonder what he's up to. You should say hey. You should get him on the podcast.
All he does is post Instagram photos.
Huh.
That's all I see him do. My entire life is just, I assume he gets paid to post Instagram photos. Oh. You know what's the weird thing about that Harden trade? This has nothing to do with the playoffs anymore, but...
People are more interested in this than they are in Grizzlies.
Yeah. I think that... and this makes me look smart in retrospect, but I did actually feel this way at the time. It's like... I always wondered why they didn't just choose Harden over Ibaka. Like, it became a Harden or Westbrook thing, but it looked like, all right, this is a perimeter-oriented league, and yeah, you need that defensive guy. Maybe they would have been much worse off not having that threat of shot blocking that Ibaka gives them. And he is a pretty good player. He gets kind of a bad rap. But it just seemed to me, I was like, you could dominate from the perimeter. Like, no one's ever going to have three perimeter defenders to take you on. And those guys are going to see enough time on the floor together to where that would just be a really, like, hard thing to deal with. And they chose to go more traditional, and it, you know, they're still very, I mean, they're, who knows where the Western playoffs would be if Westbrook never gets hurt. You know, like, they'd probably be in the middle of a great series with the Spurs right now.
Yeah, this is true. It is getting a little mid-90s Orlando Magic-y, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's an excellent point.
It's getting a little bit like that. It's not all the way like that. I believe in the end that they will win a championship just because Kevin Durant is a transcendent talent and Westbrook is pretty damn good in his own right. And it's difficult to see it. It's difficult to see it not ending in a title at some point.
Yeah.
But there are some warning signs. What you say is true. They're still in a great position. With the Ibaka thing, I got it. I understood it. Can we talk about how your dog interrupted?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, I'm restarting because your dog Your dog disagreed with me on my point. He was angry and he interrupted us, Zach.
He did, but you know what? He's just not a Kevin Durant guy.
apparently not, or he just disagreed with my idea that it was permissible to side with Ibaka at the time, even if it was the wrong decision. You know, he's got very nuanced disagreements, your dog does. My contention would just be that it's so rare to have an elite shot blocker who can hit a long two-point shot. It's such a rare combination of skills that even if the sum of his talents did not add up to that of James Harden, I can wholly understand why they chose that guy over the perimeter guys. Also, Ibaka is a terrible agent. I mean, he could have gotten so much more money.
Yeah, I wonder if that was what shaded like the James Harden situation. It was like Ibaka took considerably less market value, and you knew like a big man like that is probably going to get a close to a max contract, and it just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. I can just see that Presti and Ibaka staring each other down, and then they're at the negotiating table, the papers in front of them, and then Presti pump fakes and Ibaka goes flying, and somehow that enables the deal to get done in Presti's favor. So I see that all unfolding in my, you know, fantastical, like, imagination.
I see it as Ibaka has a pen in his hand and Presti puts out the max deal. Ibaka dives across the table, and Presti switches out the 4 years 48 to sign.
That's how it would work. That is better.
You know, let's speaking of young stars who people disagree with or like, Paul George is wholly fascinating to me now. The whole, but not him as a player, but the perception of him as a player.
Yes. It's the most interesting subplot to me of the conference finals. Is this whole Paul George has been underappreciated for so long because he's this magnificent defensive player and people don't pay attention to defense for the most part. And suddenly he's on the playoff stage against the Heat, and the type of person who doesn't know about defense and doesn't notice defense falls in love with Paul George and declares him a superstar for the same reason that same person might fall in love with Rudy Gay. And so it's just bizarre. I don't know how to process it all. I don't know what to make of it.
Well, I mean, I'm going to throw some numbers out at you.
Okay, throw them.
He's averaging 19.4 points per game on 14.7 shots per game in the playoffs, which isn't terrible. That's pretty decent, right?
Yes.
That's a pretty decent ratio. Yeah, he gets a lot of free throws. The free throws are what matters because he's shooting just 41% from the field and 30.1% from three-point range in 15 playoff games, and yet he's had a breakout playoffs.
But Zach, LeBron high-fived him. I don't think you understand that LeBron high-fived him. I don't think you get that.
I mean, I actually didn't see that at the time. I saw LeBron's shot, and then I think I went to write a note down or something. And then people on Twitter are like, "Oh, LeBron high fived him." I was like, "What? What does that matter? What is that?" I didn't really understand the significance of this moment because I missed it. And then I saw it, and I was like, "Oh, maybe there was like this really like heartfelt respect." And it was like, "No, he just reached back and like a little hand slap, and that was good."
Like,
and
LeBron also shows a lot of love to Tristan Thompson. I mean,
I
think it was a moment. I don't want to diminish it, and Paul George may well be on the road to superstardom. We just should maybe wait for that to happen, instead of ultimately declaring it that, oh, he is a superstar right now. He is, you're watching a superstar in the making, and he has a lot of skills that could amount to that.
Right.
It's just that offensively he's very shaky. He's got a high dribble. He turns the ball over a lot. He doesn't shoot efficiently. He's probably, if I had to choose my third favorite small forward or third best over Melo, over doing a defense versus defense comparison. And I wouldn't disagree if somebody wanted Melo over him, but just because you're the third best at a position doesn't necessarily make you an elite player. That's, you know, if LeBron and Durant and Melo and George all quit tomorrow, that doesn't make the guy who's next up in the small forward spot that much better. So right. I think that's kind of flawed thinking.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree with that. I would take Melo just because I think Melo's a better impact player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I know Paul George is better all around.
That's something that we don't talk about. As a distinction, no team is game planning for Paul George right now.
Right.
Maybe take advantage of certain flaws, but it's not a, oh my God, we have to stop Paul George. Just teams game plan for Carmelo Anthony. I don't know if that necessarily makes him the better player.
Right.
But it is there's so much more focus on how to deal with the Carmelo problem than how to deal with the Paul George problem.
And that's something I've tried to figure out over the last like year or two is – what does it mean to be a better player versus a better impact player? Because there was this whole discussion that I was arguing with Mavericks fans for years because they would say, oh, Dirk's better than Kevin Garnett. It was when KG was in Minnesota. I was like, well, no, he wasn't. Like, KG's clearly a better player. He's a better defender. He's a better rebounder. He's a better passer. He can dribble better. And, you know, Dirk was a better shooter, and they were about the same in scoring. It's just Dirk's scoring looked a lot prettier.
Mm-hmm.
But then I started thinking, all right, but Dirk's impact is such. Like
yes.
you definitely had a game plan for KG, but you'd game plan for Dirk in a much different way. And maybe
Dirk presented you an unsolvable problem.
Yeah.
And even if his numbers didn't necessarily reflect it individually, that Dallas offense, for instance, in 2011 and before 2011, it really hummed because teams would have to send help to deal with the Dirk problem.
Yeah, and it was help that you knew, like, he just didn't turn the ball over that much, and you weren't blocking his shot, and you weren't really affecting his shot. It was kind of just on him. So mm-hmm. It was like you were doubling, but it was like a futile effort where you probably were just better going single coverage and letting him get 45, right?
Yeah, and Beckley made a really good point, which is that they say, oh, defense is half the game, so this player who doesn't play defense, you really have to downgrade him. Defense isn't half the game if you are hidden on a poor defensive player, on a poor offensive player when you're on defense, and on the other side you dominate the ball. Then defense isn't half the game. And also, positional responsibility-wise, not every position has an equivalent impact on defense. It's a lot of it's dependent on position and role.
I think a good example on the opposite side of that, or the opposite side of the argument, but still sticking to your point, is like Kyrie Irving's a terrible defender, like really bad. But
yeah.
It doesn't really matter because they just hide him on the crappy player who is in the corner on offense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, I mean, yeah, he's guarding point guards quite a bit throughout the game, but for the most part, like, they try to hide him. So maybe his defensive problems don't matter because he's not defending the point of attack where he's so bad. So whereas, you know, Paul George, his defense is so good, and Melo's is so, I would say, average. Like, I think Melo at the four is about an average defender, which for him, is good because he's so bad at the three. So that's an improvement. I would say he's pretty average, and in that case, like, Paul George seems more important. But if you don't rely on Melo to play good defense and he's rebounding decently, does it really matter that much?
Well, they seem to maintain a good defense the year before this one. I haven't gone into the nitty-gritty of what went wrong this season with the Knicks. And yes, you can mitigate a bad. I think here's the thing with defense. You can mitigate better when the defender is farther away from the ball.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to compensate for a defensively awful center. That's just kind of death to most defenses. There's probably a way to do it. It's just difficult. And that has to be taken into consideration when talking about these players. Paul George has gotten even more interesting because we're lauding his defense. It's defense that largely doesn't matter against the guy he's playing.
That's true.
He looks like a bug on a windshield against LeBron James right now. And he played a role in LeBron having that game-ending turnover in Game 2. He got enough in front of him, had to make LeBron choose. So that was big, but for the most part, they're going to have to scrape him off LeBron's left shoulder at the end of the series.
Well, and like I don't know why I'm turning this into Melo versus Paul George. I don't mean to do this, but this is just
you're just a reflexive Melo defender. It doesn't need a rhyme or reason, Zach. It just has to happen.
We could be talking about Rondo versus Westbrook right now, and I would start saying, "Yeah, but Melo's pretty good."
You and Lala.
Lala and I are tight. We're all on Team Melo. I think the thing with with Melo, he takes a horrible shot, and we're like, "Oh, he made it," but that's he made it, but that's a terrible shot to take. Whereas Paul George knocks down that 30-footer, and we're like, "Hey, look at this guy! Look at the stones this guy has!" And it's kind of weird. I mean, I know he doesn't do it.
He's in this perfect zone. Paul George is in this perfect zone where
he literally can't lose.
He can't lose because the only people who knew about him were the evangelists, were the basketball nerds who appreciated his defense and some of his other qualities and wanted everybody to know about him. Nobody else knew about him. So now there's no contingent. This is what you are witnessing right now. What we are experiencing right now is how it eventually turns on the athlete getting criticized. What you need for it to happen is for the player to become prominent enough that fans of a similar player will get resentful and lash out. And that's what we're seeing right now, Zach, with your Carmelo Anthony love fueling your Paul George criticism.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe I love Melo so much that I don't like Paul George.
You don't like him getting that attention.
I don't.
I mean, there's so much of that. I noticed it where people, when Steph Curry was having similar accolades at the beginning of the playoffs, I noticed that the people kind of grousing and carping were fans of Rondo or fans of another point guard. It's easily traceable. We're very funny that way. We can be these heavily involved, supposedly objective analysts of basketball, and at the same time, there's an element of, you know, my guy's better than that guy.
It's funny to me how nobody cared about the Pacers as a contender getting into the series. Like some people were like, "Oh no, I thought they would be competitive," but I also said there was no chance they'd win this series. And they play them tough in game one, and there's controversy, and then they steal game two, and now all of a sudden it's like, well, hey, maybe the Heat aren't going to win this series. And I find that to be such a weird reaction. I know we're very much based on recency, and we love to, like, hey, something different happened, so let's jump on this bandwagon and see what, and like pick it apart and see what's there, because maybe there's something we could take from it. But it's funny to me the roller coaster of reactions we get.
Oh, well, I think it started with the Pacers before the Knicks series, and a lot of this is just discovery. A lot of this is people not ever seeing a team and not having to think about it, and therefore the threat doesn't seem that imminent, and the team doesn't seem that good. And then suddenly they see them as, oh my God, this team doesn't suck. They could do some things, and that's what's happened with the Pacers. It's a little bit what we're seeing with Paul George, where people who never thought about Paul George suddenly see him, and it's just the first time. It's the first impression, and that's so much of it. So it's a bit of recency combined with discovery. The Pacers, that starting five, they're just so well balanced as a team. They've got this ironic, maybe not ironic, but they've got this paradoxical mix of a well balanced team.
Yeah.
With no bench.
Bench sucks.
So it's
what's funny is some people asked me yesterday, they're like during the game, like, why is Sam Young getting minutes? And I said, I just want to remind you, this is how badly Gerald Green is at basketball. This is how bad he plays. This is how bad Gerald Green is at Sam Young.
Gerald Green for you was your guard version of Anthony Randolph.
Oh my God, I couldn't stand him. It's like there's a reason he doesn't play. It's because he sucks. And well, I did, this guy, Gerald Green, is very good at shooting competitions at the end of practice. I watched him taking on Danny Granger this past week, and he's very confident in shooting contests.
Yeah, you know, his problem is short arms, Zach. It's not basketball IQ. He's got stubby arms. That's what I'm going to reduce it to.
His problem is he can't dribble, pass, defend, or shoot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what annoys you about this is that people aren't grasping they're not respecting the intelligence of an NBA player and just the professionalism that goes into it. There's right. just this assumption. This guy can jump. It's the Charles Barkley runs like a deer, jumps like a deer, thinks like a deer, and there's not a whole lot of accounting for the latter quality, if you will. And so that's annoying. I also think's happening with this talking up of the Pacers? Hmm. Besides, they're good. They're really good.
Yeah, they're really good.
They could potentially win this series, especially if Dwayne Wade keeps looking inconsistent, to put it generously. A lot of it also is that we want drama. We want to be entertained, so we talk ourselves into the possibility as it happens. We got to play it up. I mean, because somebody must have whispered into Barkley's ear and Kenny Smith's ear, choose the Pacers. Pick the Pacers to win the series. It's drama. It gets the people interested.
And it's a thing where we were so worried about this being a boring playoffs, right? Like, once Westbrook went down and we weren't terribly thrilled with the first round, it was like, oh, this is boring. The Heat are just going to march on. And then
the Pacers will save us.
Yeah, the Pacers provide a little resistance, and Roy Hibbert is so engaging, and he's still kind of polarizing. And Paul George is this budding flower of skill and execution that can't hit a shot right now, but he's incredible.
That's what I love. As I loved about yesterday, Paul George had, I think, 4 points in the first half. People were, where's Paul George? Where is he? And I'm thinking, this happens a lot with Paul George. Yeah. He's not there yet, guys.
Yeah,
settle down.
He's not there. Like, maybe in 2 years he'll be like this. He'll be what we're talking about him being now. But he's not. It's not yet.
Yes.
He's no Melo.
What was also funny is that people were talking about the first two games, which frankly weren't feats of basketball mastery. If he misses that desperation 3-point heave in game one, he finishes 5 of 14 with I think something like 16 points.
Yeah,
you know, he had a great overtime afterwards, and then the next game he had that awesome dunk on Birdman, but I think he scored what? I don't have the stats in front of me. So it was like 22 points and 6 assists. These weren't spellbinding performances. It was just so strange right. to see people get a completely wrapped up in it.
Yeah, I guess he is a little bit more like Melo than I thought. If he was going 5 of 14 for 16 points, that might be just enough Melo. Maybe I do like Paul George now.
Well, you can talk yourself into it. You know, we don't want to be left out in the cold when the Paul George thing. I do have a respect for the wisdom of crowds, and if everyone's saying that he's going to be a superstar, I don't want to be left out in the cold when the good ship Paul George superstardom sets sail. I don't want to be left out there on the dock, you know?
I do actually. I mean, I do think he's good, and I think he's going to be a really good player. I also think he got the All-Star bid, and I think he got the All-NBA third team by default. I think he got it because Paul Pierce wasn't good this year.
Yeah, we kind of have a forwards issue.
We
have to make this team comprised of people of these positions, but there's more talent in the guard positions perhaps than at that spot. At the same time, I mean, David Lee, third team? What is going on? What is that?
It's incredible how David Lee keeps getting all these accolades over Steph Curry. It's just got to be the position, right?
That's part of it. It's the position. With the voting, how the voting happened, you have a lot of just beat reporters. And they know of David Lee. He played in New York. You know, he made the All-Star team. So there is that influence to it. But man, that was just ridiculous. There are so many better choices there. I don't get it. And a lot of people were in these parts were a little disappointed to see Curry not on the team. At the very least, every guard chosen has a case against him. I would put him on one of the All-NBA teams. But I get why certain guys were chosen above him. It makes sense to me. I would probably give his spot to Tony Parker because of minutes played, but you know, I would get why somebody wouldn't. It's not crazy to me.
Right. That was kind of my thinking in the whole Gasol versus Duncan thing was, mm-hmm. I'll take the guy who's done it in more minutes and more games because, you know, I do think that matters, but in the context of what the Spurs are, I get why that shouldn't matter as much because this is what they ask of their players. They ask them to take reduced minutes and
Their fault. Yeah, you know, exactly. It's not Tony Parker's fault that Popovich wants to manage his minutes.
Well, and in the Curry situation, if they get eliminated in the first round and he doesn't have a great series, do people care? Would they be saying he deserves 13?
And here's the other question. One of the reasons why, aside from my blatant homerism, why I would choose Curry for the All-NBA team, I do think it matters that Curry got better as the year went along. That does matter to me, that after the All-Star break, Curry's numbers were ridiculous. After the All-Star break, if we're doing an after the All-Star break All-NBA team, Curry's first team. But we don't have such a thing, so not...
He had that record in sight, and he wanted it.
Yes, he definitely had that record in sight. He was selfishly gunning for it, which was actually probably good for the offense. But, I mean, 26 points a game, 9 threes a game, 46% on the threes. I mean, it was ridiculous. And so I can't come up with a tangible reason for why that should matter, but it matters to me that he was better towards the end than he was at the beginning.
No, the games at the end of the season matter more. They're worth 1.5 wins.
I clearly remember them better, so they have. That was something I was thinking about. This is a total digression. Is that, can you honestly? I'm just going to put you on the spot right now. Can you remember a single thing from a sports pregame show that was said?
Oh no, I don't really watch them, so that's a problem. I don't watch like the TNT stuff before. I don't watch the ESPN or ABC stuff before. Like I don't care about pregame stuff because I feel like. This is very egotistical, but I feel like I've already looked into what I want to look into. And so unless it's like a cool interview, like Rachel Nichols interviews Phil Jackson, like I'd like to see that. But in terms of like talking about the game before it happens, I snobbishly, like, you know, I write about the NBA for a living. Like, I feel like
You've seen hours of TNT pre-games. You've caught them. I can't remember a single thing. I mean, we're getting to the why they're so meaningless. I mean, you're just skipping them. That goes to show you.
Yeah, true. Like, that's the thing. It's like, I can remember a lot about post-game stuff. Like, yeah. I love the post-game stuff, but pre-game stuff just has never really mattered to me for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably an ego thing.
Okay, here's a post-game curveball, and we're not gonna get into any X's and O's about Pacers Heat. It is what it is.
Yeah.
Deal with it, people. I put this out on Twitter. I believe, and you responded and got into this whole discussion with Miles and John Krolik. I believe that TNT Shaq and TNT Reggie Miller have tainted how people viewed their careers. I see more criticism of the way those guys played now than ever before, and I'm convinced it's just because people are annoyed with their broadcasting.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean, especially with Reggie. I think Shaq is more of a... People did complain a lot about Shaq, like, being fat and being, like, just...
Yeah.
He's too big to not be good, which I don't believe that, but that's how a lot
too
of people
too big say, to fail.
Yeah, exactly. People would say, "Oh, if I was that big, I'd dominate too." It's like, well, no, you wouldn't. He had quite a bit of skill and agility, and it's not just about being big. But there was like this disconnect between them. But at the same time, I think there is a degree where what you're saying is true. I just don't think I think Reggie's is a lot more damaging to his career, and I think we saw the same thing. With the kind of basketball mind Mark Jackson is. If Mark Jackson never goes into broadcasting and he goes, he's a player, he retires, 2 years later he's a coach,
yeah,
I think people would say, like, oh, what a great hire. What a great hire.
Yeah, that guy was the smartest player I've seen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they don't. It completely can change. And with Reggie, I think it's immense because Reggie Miller had this aura of cool to him that immediately evaporates when he starts talking.
Yeah, he's so not cool on the broadcast. Whereas before it was he's yelling at New York, he's taking them on, he's throwing choke signs at Spike Lee. Like, he was cool. He was abrasive. He was in your face.
Yeah.
He was talking trash to everybody. He got MJ to push him. Like, it was all this stuff and like, oh my God, what a badass. And now you hear him talk and it's like, yikes, that wasn't a good call.
Now it's a bad mix of dorky
And I don't know that it's fair because I'm not crazy about his style of broadcast and things he says, but I don't know that what he's saying isn't true. You know, like
sometimes you do.
when he's talking about
pocket squares, I don't think nerds wear pocket squares.
Right. Well, when he says Serge Ibaka should be defensive player of the year because of his field goal percentage, that's a bad call. that's not a good argument. But there are a lot of things where. That's like when you hear Magic Johnson talk, it's like he's not articulate in the way that people want him to be, but he's a great personality. And I do think, like, I would never think I know more about basketball than Magic Johnson. Like, that guy has such an incredible encyclopedic, like, mind to his basketball knowledge, and I would never pretend. But there are people who think, like, oh, he's an idiot, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And it's crazy to me.
Well, I don't think what people understand is that when a camera turns on, I mean, you instantly, a lot of people get a lot dumber.
Oh, God, if this was a video cast instead of a podcast, I'd be all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, I would have already given Paul George the finals MVP, which might happen. You know, it has not happened, but I would have.
Sure, it might happen.
Making the most, just these loud, pay attention to me. I'm just going to say whatever keeps you paying attention to my face, my talk.
I wouldn't come off as this like brilliant, good-looking, articulate person as I do on the regular podcast, you know?
it's harder to pull off. Yeah. The thing with Magic, though, is that people have been critical of his commentary, and I have to be careful because I do ESPN articles, but I don't believe it seeped into how people analyze his game.
Oh, no,
whereas with Shaq and with Reggie, we have the element of Reggie's aura of cool being shattered, and people begin to pick apart how he just ran around and shot. And I thought Reggie was great, so I'm not of that camp. And with Shaq, as Miles pointed out, it really makes you look at that whole trope of him running, of Kobe running Shaq out of town.
Sure.
You look at it and you go, oh, man, I'm totally team Kobe now.
For sure. No, you definitely are. And at the time, I was totally team Shaq. I thought it was ridiculous. I thought it was rude. But you go back and hear some stories. You hear some things from reporters who were around. And it's like, oh, maybe this wasn't such a one-sided affair. Or maybe it was one-sided, but it was the other way. Maybe it was all Shaq's fault. And I think this is something that I wonder how many people really dislike the commentary, or if it's just basketball culture on the internet dislikes it, because I feel like
there's something unlikable about Shaq.
But here's the thing.
He's got a kind of a middle school bully thing going.
Oh no, he definitely does. But here's the thing that I think is, like, the pregame shows and the postgame shows aren't for the basketball nerds like us. They're not. It's for all that stuff is like mass produced for the casual fan to rope them in. And when Magic Johnson is talking to the casual fan, I don't think they really care. I think they're like, oh my God, that's Magic Johnson. Yeah, I kind of agree with that point. There, he did a good job. And whether he's right or not, I don't think it matters. Whereas our brains have we've molded ourselves to become these like analytical pricks, you know, that overanalyze everything.
Anapriticals.
Anapriticals. That's a great term.
Criticals. It's very hard to pronounce.
Yeah. We've just become part of this culture where we try to tear everything apart. And it's kind of dumb. It's kind of like too much work for not any reward.
But it all comes back to the thing that we've discussed on the internet, where everybody is trying to assert their intellectual dominance. And one of the ways you do that is by making fun of people.
And I love it
to a certain extent. But you know who's more guilty of it, Zach? Our evil mentions on Twitter. I love what you say about when you say this. If I just tell you you're smart, will you go away?
It used to be where I would start flirting with the people who are telling me I'm an idiot, and because it makes them uncomfortable. And now it's gotten to the point where I will just say, like, look, if I tell you I think you're smart, can we just end this conversation? Like, I just don't care. I don't. Like, someone got mad. Tom Haverstraw wrote a great piece on. I think it was Insider, maybe it was on Heat Index, about how Jordan was wrong about saying you would push LeBron left because, look, he's the best scorer in the league going left. And someone said, you know, LeBron hits the game-winning layup by going left because Paul George completely overplayed. And he didn't even overplay, he just played stupidly. It wasn't an overplay. He just slid for some reason. Like, he went like Jamiroquai virtual insanity. He just starts sliding across the floor for no reason. And so he goes left, he scores, and it's like, see, Jordan was wrong. And it's a cool little article idea. It's catchy. It gets a lot of interest, but people start screaming like, LeBron will never be Jordan, and they're like including me on this.
Oh God,
and
the Jordan, like, and the Jordanites.
And I come to the conclusion like, I don't care. I don't care if LeBron is ever going to beat Jordan, be better than Jordan.
Yeah, I don't care.
I don't care if he's not. Like, I don't care. I got to watch Jordan growing up, and I loved it. And yeah. Now in my professional career, I've gotten to watch LeBron play basketball and evolve as a player, and I love it. And they're separate things, and I don't ever feel the need to compare the two feelings, because I'm not even the same basketball fan that I was back then. I don't know if I'm a better fan or a worse fan now, but yeah. I view the game differently because I'm no longer a child who is just in awe of everything. Now I'm an anapritical, as you created. That is really hard to say.
We might need another term.
Yeah, and it's not that catchy.
No, it's very bad. It's very.
See,
it's
look at us.
Not one of my better moments.
This is us. We're tearing. We just came up with a word we liked, and now we're tearing it down. This is the
problem. No, but I'm with you on this, man, because. You talked about the awe that you had as a kid watching Jordan, as I did, as we all did. He's the greatest basketball player of all time. But what ends up happening is a lot of people who are now in their 20s who had that awe, their 20s and early 30s, for Jordan, they just won't let it go. They won't let it go. I just want to tell them. I want to just look. Don't worry. Jordan's legacy is safe.
Yeah.
He's the greatest player. Nobody's going to tear down their legacy of Jordan. Nobody's going to forget about Michael Jordan. Will you just relax and enjoy the NBA again? Will you just relax? Will you just, you know, LeBron James, maybe he'll never be Jordan. Whatever, he's a great player. Let's just enjoy it. I don't really want to compare everything he does to what guys in a less athletic era would have done, supposedly. It just doesn't serve any purpose at all.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's just such a different game now with different strategies, different defenses, different rules. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me to compare it anymore, because it's a different NBA. And like, and even like people say, oh, if that foul happened in the 80s, it wouldn't be a flagrant. I was like, well, yeah, they'd also be called for defensive 3 seconds every trip down the floor, because there is no help, there is no shading to the strong side, like there's none of that, like it's.
Also, I remember a ton of flagrant fouls in the 90s. It wasn't like you would just punch somebody and then go play on.
even before the malice of the palace, like Kenyon Martin used to. Just throw people into the stands all the time. Like he would push players into the baseline, into the camera people all the time. They'd call flagrant fouls, and this wasn't great 80s, 90s tough basketball. This was just a punk move. Like, and it still happens every once in a while, and it should be called a flagrant. Like there's a progression of the game.
Yeah, there's a progression of the game, and we should be okay with that. And we should realize that your greatness is defined by how great you are relative to the other people playing the game, which is, I think that Michael Jordan's the greatest ever because he was the greatest at that time, not because he'll beat everybody to play after him forever. That's an unfair standard. It's unfair. It's unfair to Jordan, frankly. And I just don't have any respect for the analysis of people who just think the game doesn't progress. They're just ignoring what's happening in front of our eyes. I mean, a Gotham coach who the guy, he says a lot of funny stuff, and he has some really cool gifs, but he was talking about how, oh, he'd love to see this Bad Boys Pistons team completely steamroll this Miami Heat team. And are you insane? Are you crazy that you think that would happen?
LeBron
weighs more than Bill Laimbeer did.
Yeah, LeBron.
They've got bigger, faster, stronger on the wings.
Yeah, I mean, LeBron's just, a bigger – he's like the same size as Bill Laimbeer. They weigh the same.
It's crazy.
They weigh the same, except one is muscle and the other one was like, you know, Coors Light. Like, that was that's the two comparisons. Like, Bill Laimbeer would bounce off of LeBron.
It's just, if you look at Kevin McHale, and, you know, it's a little complicated by how that era was in some ways a little bit bigger because big men had more favorable rules and it wasn't as fast a game. But just, I don't understand why anybody would honestly believe, you brought them into an interrogation room, do you believe that the average team from the past or that teams from the past would just work and dominate this multi-billion dollar industry that just keeps working harder to produce better and better talent.
There's got to be, how long do you give them to adjust to new rules and new concepts? Like,
That's the other complicating factor.
Yeah, do you let them, like, take a month to study, like, Thibodeau's, like, side pick and roll defense? How long do you give? There's so many questions. There's no vacuum here. We're vacuumless.
There's no way to figure it out. There's no way to know it, and that's why it's good to have the context of what's changed in mind when we analyze who did what. But it's unfair to both sides. It's unfair to the people who will never get to have their be tested against.
I'm sure there's somebody who's 60 years old who thinks Dr. J was way better than Jordan. I don't know why everyone's freaking out. Like,
yeah.
It's just. You have personal tastes and stuff. I think Jordan's the greatest player ever. Do I think LeBron can get there? I don't know. Maybe. His career's like halfway over.
Well, I don't think he's ever going to have that dominance of the game that Jordan did, in part because of how the game is. I'm not making excuses for LeBron, but it's just the old game was easier in some ways to dominate because it was more conducive to an isolation-style scoring. This game, there's just so much more going on, and there's more variance because people shoot more threes, so you can be the better team and lose because the other team just hits a bunch of threes. So it's much harder to control than it was back in the day. So I believe we may never see the kind of dominance that we saw with Jordan, combined with how Jordan was just this awesome talent, and it's so rare that somebody is so much better than the next guy.
I am reading Tim Grover's book right now, Relentless. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've read it, but it's a fascinating look into the mentality, and he's trying to be like a motivational speaker almost through this book. And and the concept is you want to be a cleaner. Cleaners are like, there is no killer instinct. It's just, this is what you do, blah, blah, blah. You don't turn on the fourth quarter. You never turn it off. Like, it's this very, like, I don't know. It's this weird macho concept. It's a quick read. It's fascinating. And the only problem I have with it is very repetitive. So you could probably just read half of it and get the exact same concept, but
seems like a trainer would make something that was repetitive.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you do feel like you're being drilled constantly through
60 word sit-ups for you, yeah. Zach.
And so he does like have some anecdotes about like Kobe and Jordan and how and then he just like rips LeBron throughout it, like saying, like recognizing he's a great player and everything, but saying he's not a cleaner, he's a closer, and there's a difference. You don't want to be a closer, you want to be a cleaner, and all this terminology and crap. But there are parts where he's like, and this is the part where I've gotten with LeBron, is Grover makes the point of, if LeBron or if Jordan made one of two, like in his career, he made one of every two shots. Like, he shot 50, he was just that good of a shooter. Mm-hmm. And part of it was his strength and his explosiveness, and he was ahead of the time and blah, blah, blah. And we've gotten to the point now with LeBron where it's, yeah, he's expected to make one out of every two shots at least. And probably more than that. And I think that's just a sign of like this transcendent greatness of whether he's better than Jordan or not. The fact that he's gotten to a point where if he shoots less than one of two every time, that's a disappointment for him, and that's kind of cool, right?
Yeah,
like that's a cool that's a cool expectation to have of a player.
I was surprised in game three that he missed. Well, that was just a crazy game in a lot of ways. And I mean, the Pacers drew 44 free throws, had a plus 12 offensive rebound advantage, hit 57% of their threes, and got blown out. I don't think I've ever seen that before, that combination of things. But it was surprising. It is notable when LeBron misses most of his shots. I think according to maybe it was Cooper Moorhead, he's only done it. That was the 18th time he's done it this season.
Yeah, that's a ridiculous stat.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Especially with the three-pointers he's taking. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of crazy, and it speaks to a certain level of mastery. One of the reasons this series is so intriguing is because you get the sense that the Pacers take him out of his comfort zone, and principally Roy Hibbert does. I would recommend everybody read Henry Abbott's piece on how LeBron alters his game for Roy Hibbert. So I just I wonder if we're going to see that typical level of control over the course of the series as it moves forward.
Well, we do have the two biggest superstars in the world between LeBron James Paul George. And Paul George. So that's the reason to watch.
We do. I love that this has become a thing. It's really it's something. It might look okay in the future if he becomes what people think he will become.
Yeah.
But it's going to be so hilarious if we just save everything and he just remains at this level forever.
And it's gonna become a thing where I am actually gonna start hating him because it's gonna be too over the top, and I'm gonna feel this pressure, this egotistical pressure to bring it all the way back so that we have some kind of middle ground. Just
I would just save every article right now comparing the high five to Bird and Magic's high five and saying that Paul George is the new LeBron and he's the new superstar. Just save everything in case it goes south, as crappy a tendency as that is, just because, hey, I'm going to be very disappointed if Paul George doesn't become this thing, but this would be a pretty funny consolation prize if it doesn't work out.
I do think like there is kind of a cool thing about the slap in the five or something. Like, it's kind of a cool moment, I guess, but it's just weird. Like, and maybe he stepped it up because he's a cleaner. Maybe he steps it up because it's that part of the playoffs where you know everything's on the line. Or apparently things aren't on the line the first round, but he was not good the first two rounds. Like, I can't get this out of my head. Like, I walked away thinking you're turning the ball over way too much and you can't hit a shot. And now he's a superstar. I'm like, I don't agree with that. I don't know.
Yeah, just let's let it develop. Let's let it. It's a funny thing. I don't want to make everything about Steph Curry and mention him a bunch of times.
Oh, I do
but,
the same thing about Rubio. Go for it.
Yeah, it's just hard. But it's a totally different conversation from the one with Steph Curry versus Paul George, where is Curry this right now versus will Paul George be this eventually?
Yeah.
And yet the conversations were exactly the same.
It is. Oh, wow. That's a good point. It is the exact same thing. Basically, yeah. Well, and I even wrote, like, I think Curry, you know, I agreed with your point that I think you made this months ago. You were like, Curry's on pace to be the greatest 3-point shooter ever. And then he had that historic season, and I was like, yeah, this guy is the best 3-point shooter ever.
Yeah, but the worst ankles ever.
Yeah, assuming he is going to keep this up.
Mm-hmm.
And if Paul George keeps this up, then yeah, I'm in. But I just don't know that it's...
No, it's more if Paul George gets better. That's the thing.
Well,
it's
he does have to get better because he can't hit a shot right now.
If Curry maintains what he's done over the past few months, you know, and that's very debatable with the ankles, so we'll just... I have no clue. I have no clue. But then that's a Hall of Fame career. If Paul George is what he's been the past few months, then that's a massive disappointment. So it's a totally different – it's just a different circumstance. And, now there's all this drama and intrigue surrounding Paul George. Like, poor Paul George has all these expectations foisted onto himself.
Because he hit a crazy shot and he dunked on Chris Anderson. That's what it is. You take those two plays out and no one cares.
Yeah. If they lose to the Hawks in the first round, nobody's
– You know, you mentioned you know, saving all these Paul George articles right now. I really hope nobody goes and finds that Steph Curry article to hold over my head in 3 years when he's hobbled and.
Oh, which one? Which one in particular?
Where I wrote that he's the greatest 3-point shooter ever.
Oh, but come on! I mean, it's the greatest stretch of however many seasons he's been around that anybody's had yet. So at least he'll cling to that. I mean, everybody knows the risk inherent with him. Everybody knows that he has landmines for ankles. Everybody gets that. They know the deal, you know.
I think that we've come to it's going to turn into Steph Curry versus Paul George, and then it'll just be the winner of that.
This is how it all works, Zach. This is what I'm saying. It's like
to take on LeBron.
Someone gets defensive on behalf of their favorite star, and they start tearing down the other one. Like right now, we've shifted from you and Melo to me saying, you know, Steph Curry's better than Paul George right now.
You're a liar. You took Paul George on Twitter the other day. I saw it.
Oh, my out with that one was the ankles. Like I just if somebody could tell me that Steph Curry's ankles are now made of titanium and he'll never hurt them again, then I would pick Curry over George. But the ankles are real, man. I mean, it's a chronic for a lot of players.
So this has turned into Curry versus Paul George. The winner takes on LeBron, and in my head, Melo's still the real winner. But over all of them, and I don't even know why I like LeBron more than I like Melo.
Why are we so defensive, on behalf of these players that don't even care?
This is what it is. It's because we don't have any idea what we're talking about. Like, we can fake it, but we don't know. Every time I hear, I talk to a scout or I hear a scout talking and I'm eavesdropping, I just realize, I have no idea what I'm doing in this business. I really don't, and none of us do, and that's why we make a point and then we get super defensive about it for no reason, just because we don't want to be wrong, so it validates us. And what I'm saying is, I'm a fraud.
That's really the greatest accomplishment, that you've peddled a total ignorance into people paying attention to you, Zach. I think you should edit this part out. You should just keep it going. You should, I mean, that's what I plan to do. I mean, well, then again, I occasionally admit to it. I like admitting to being wrong when I'm wrong. It feels gratifying.
It's the great equalizer.
It's great. It's great to just go, hey, I was wrong.
It's such an 8 mile move.
I thought the last Grizzlies would win this series.
Yeah.
I was incorrect.
it's the last rap battle in 8 Mile where Eminem says all the bad stuff about himself in a rap and then throws the mic at the other guy, and the guy's silent, and that's what you do. That's what you do in the arguments. You're like, this guy's like, you're an idiot, you're wrong. You're like, I know I was wrong. I was wrong about this, and this. And the guy's like,
I don't know what to do.
Yeah, I don't know what to do.
You throw the whole "I know something about you, I know you went to a private school" move on him, and there you go.
That's the thing. You go through the guy's tweets and you're like, no, you said this, and I'm wrong about this, and they have no idea what to do. What I'm saying is 8 Mile should run your life. It's a decent movie.
I'm considering it. I'm just a little worried about how adopting some of the practices that the late Brittany Murphy did. That's my only concern.
Seems like an awful idea. I have no idea how long this podcast has run because I'm recording on a new program that doesn't exactly give me a running time.
Yeah.
And my dog interrupted for what felt like 35 minutes. It could have just been 3. I don't know, but it felt like 35. I'm assuming we ran long, so I'm going to cut it off.
Oh, we ran way long. Okay. You can. I only ask that you don't edit this to make me sound as foolish as I am. That's my only thing.
I'm only gonna edit it down to the smart things that I said, which might be 4 or 5 things. So I think that's what I'm gonna do. It's just gonna turn into "I love Carmelo Anthony." That might be the title of this podcast. "I love Carmelo Anthony" with Ethan Sherwood's dress.
There you go. Title it that. That will get the hits. That will get the listenership.
Well, Ethan,
I'll tell you what.
Ethan, warriorsworld.net. You've got some ESPN articles. We can follow you at Sherwood Strauss. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Oh, always a pleasure, Zach. You have a great day.
You too.